Hey everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, returning to shine a light into the darkness once again as we delve into the evolutionary narrative lurking beneath the facade of the hit crime show Mindhunter, which dramatizes the true story of John Douglas, an FBI profiler who came to prominence in the 1970s as an innovator in the Bureau's Behavioral Science Unit. The show aired for two seasons, taking us from Douglas's early days as an instructor at Quantico, through his conversations with serial killers like Edmund Kemper and David Berkowitz, leading up to a shocking culmination, which is the controversial profiling and subsequent capture of the Atlanta monster, Wayne Williams. The show was created by Joe Penhall, based upon the 1995 book of the same name, written by John Douglas and Mark Olshaker. But perhaps the most noticeable contribution, in terms of its stylistic presentation, is from executive producer David Fincher, who, in many brilliant films from Seven to Zodiac, has shown a very strong inclination toward indulging the psychological aspects of dark crime material. On a personal note, if I could have any director make a movie about a serial killer in an unsolved case, and choose my suspect as the guilty party, it would be Fincher directing a film about Arthur Lee Allen being Zodiac. So, strangely enough, I got my wish. And with Mindhunter, Fincher fans get the same. We want to know what it was like to come face to face with those monsters and hear their scary tales. This show takes us inside that place, which is, quite frankly, into the minds of the killers, back to the point of origin about a singular yet evasive truth. Why? One of the more beautiful yet underappreciated aspects of Fincher's work is that he is seemingly obsessed with utilizing a green tint or hue in all of his work, leaving dark, dreary scenes saturated in an inescapable glaze. He claims to do this because most TV shows and films, for a long time, had a propensity for being comprised with what he describes as a pink hue. The green acts as a strong contrast to that, or, perhaps more appropriately, eradicates that pink hue, at least to the specifications of the director's intentions. Yet, what it does for the viewer, even though it remains only intuitive for most, is that it brings the color of growth, or green, into some very dark places. So no matter how many people in Zodiac or Mindhunter suffer, get killed, or go to prison, indulging this darkness leaves them saturated in the notion of the color green as being symbolic of growth. And that is what's happening here. Things that are green, such as plants, grow from the darkness below the surface, rising slowly to reveal the truth about what they are. Of course, it isn't a coincidence that countless people have posed the question of why it's always raining in Fincher shows and movies. That's why. Water is indicative of symbolic rebirth. And through the conduit of rain, we are allowed a perspective of the burden of that transformation coming down hard on us, oppressively, leaving us nowhere to hide. Therefore, his protagonists are often left out in the rain, soaked. And as they get watered in darkness below the surface in their minds, the unconscious, so to speak, by way of knowledge attained on their journey over the course of time, that growth, aka the green, will rise into the light and reveal itself for what it is. So falling water is used to symbolize the oppressive nature of ignorance, of emotional darkness, of not knowing. But in truth, like a plant being watered, this inundation, this oppression, is leading to growth. Green is in the middle of the color scale, so it is the symbolic tipping point between light and darkness, or, you could say, the place where the earth meets the sky and where the rain meets the seed. In the same way, realizations from your unconscious mind rise through the subconscious like a staircase on their way to the light of the rational mind above, The plant does the same. It climbs from the ignorance of the darkness below, making a staircase, so to speak, by way of its growth, allowing ascension to the light above, where the seed of an idea it once was will be realized as fully manifested, with a life taking place both below the surface and above, just like you. The plant grows over time, breaking through from the ignorance of darkness back when it was only a seed to become a fully manifested adult version of its intentions upon crossing the threshold or transcendence point of the seeker and the sought, or the place where the ground meets the air. It rises toward the heavens, blossoming as it does, just as we do, collectively. That's us. Actually, it's everything. Everything in your world is comprised of point A, point B, and the journey between, whether you're going out to grab a carton of milk, leaving a cave to hunt a buffalo, or exploring space. So think of the singularity as the seed of our evolution, meaning the plant's growth. The singularity, like the seed, breaks apart more or less, and like the Big Bang, so that what's inside can expand exponentially in an effort to lay the groundwork for the life to come. This happens in total darkness for the seed, as it did in our evolutionary narrative with the singularity. In the beginning, there was no light. The Big Bang was not an explosion. It was simply an expansion or inflation. It happens in darkness. The universe, like the seed endeavoring to become a plant, wouldn't see light for quite some time. In excess of 300,000 years of evolution. So in this show, whether intentional or not, we should see that conformity to the idea of the plant growing from beneath the surface, rising into the light from a seed of an idea to a fully fledged version of what it was intended to be. If I'm right about that, this story should begin in the basement of Quantico and rise into the light from there as our seed, or protagonist, grows to fruition. Of course, that's exactly what happens. Now, with any show or movie, the protagonist's goal is becoming something. We are always becoming. Evolution, or life, is comprised only of constant change and nothing else, and therefore our plight, both individually and collectively, is always correlated to the idea of becoming. We are either transcending or failing to transcend. There is only yes and no, and the door between those two places, which is either locked or open. I got the job. I didn't get the job. I got the concert tickets. I didn't get the concert tickets. I want to be the CEO. I didn't get the CEO job. I want to be pretty, but I'm ugly. I want to be tall, but I'm short. I want to be respected, but they only laugh. I want the new car, but can't afford it. Or you can. But either way, there is nothing in our existence beyond yes, no, and suspense between, related to whether or not that door is going to be open or closed. Everything else is just window dressing for the facade of civilized society. Like the plant, we start in one position, at the bottom, in darkness, absent of resources needed to grow. But over time, we acquire the knowledge to evolve and push upward, breaking through into the light, ascending to bring truth. We do that through the conduit of the Father above, or God, and so in Mindhunter, we should expect to see the same thing. The boss is upstairs, above the basement, above ground, in the light, and oppressing his employees, forcing them to grow from their current selves or ego into their authentic selves and push the truth upward from below the ground in darkness and ignorance back into the light. That process will free them. But as we evolve, in the same way as the plant growing or a child, we assume a role in relation to the light or the father or boss or parent, which continues to change based upon our latest disposition of knowledge. Parents don't talk to their 16-year-old kids the way they would speak to them when they were 4, and the difference is their evolution, their lack of ignorance in comparison to their younger counterparts. They know more truth, and therefore must be treated with such respect in relation to knowledge, and fewer secrets are then kept between the parties. One of the interesting things about maturing to adulthood is that, over time, it humanizes your parents as you take on their struggles and realize the truth that was hidden from you when you were young. Your parents, or parent, or whomever raised you, indulged an increasingly less viable facade over time, one intended to protect you from the truth about the horrors in this world until you were mature enough to know about them, aka until you saw the light yourself through experience, like the plant maturing to break through the ground into the light above without ever knowing what was really up there until it did. That's us. We can't see the future of our ascension in this darkness. But as we mature, as we evolve, as we ascend toward deification, or becoming the creator, in the same way you might have become a parent, we begin to glean insight about why the truth was kept from us. And the answer is comfort. Ignorance is bliss. Right now, you get to pretend that you have a life complete with free will, in which democratically processed elections allow you and everyone else to choose whatever they want to do, and based upon considerations derived from how you were raised, specifically your values. So you go out and boycott this or support that and believe that your vote, along with cooperation from bad people who just need to see their logic is wrong, will change the world. But it won't, it can't, and it never has. We live a life in which we are convinced that our perception is the truth, and that the construction of life matches that perception. It's convenient. It's also false. I don't get to have that life. I'm not afforded that comfort. Beneath that social veil of autonomy is the existence of evolutionary necessity, and bringing that roadmap to the surface defines Mindhunter. However, Mindhunter still operates within the social veil, utilizing a psychological landscape in which free will and choices led to the results. For that reason, meaning antiquated knowledge on the verge of obsolescence, the universe is like, bro, we're done after season 2. Why? Because they're lying to you in that show, but in a very good way. There is no nature versus nurture. There is no question of whether a psychopath or sociopath is born or raised. 50 years ago, these were profound questions and entirely relevant. Today, however, they're proving nothing less than ludicrous. Choice, or free will, means absence of necessity, yet we live in a universe dependent upon necessity. The construction of our universe betrays the notion of free will being possible, and that's why autonomy is presented to you in a veiled way. You believe you have choices, from votes to boycotts to what you'll have for dinner, but all of that is written, coded. You and I are scripted products. DNA is a coded script. Your genetic predisposition is also coded script, like software. And the point of understanding that is it allows you to focus your evolution accordingly. We don't need to know about choices. It doesn't allow us to evolve. If you ask, why did Ed Kemper kill? You get a bunch of very sophisticated horseshit about decisions related to emotional deficit. And yes, they're on the right track with that assessment, but the place where we need to go at this point is one in which there is no woulda, coulda, shoulda. No fantasy land. The one where we say people's choices led to the result. We have to get past that now. That was yesterday. Again, that's antiquated thinking. Even if you're one of the people who is undoubtedly sitting there right now, utilizing an arrogant false sense of reason and logic to determine that I'm definitely wrong, well, the truth is, you're actually just calibrated to not have this realization at this time. Evolution peels away layers of deception on its way to one glorious truth about the light. So on that path, it requires the overwhelming majority of humans to sit around calling the innovators crazy, until which point the innovators evolve them. It amazes me that the plight the characters in Mindhunter face is one in which they're called crazy and are marginalized for trying to evolve criminal psychology, yet they were right all along, and here we are, decades later, even with historical precedence, seeing people still insist on calling me crazy. That's not indulgence of logic. You are designed to have those doubts, not because you're right, but because the truth always has to break through into the light above by overcoming the dark forces of oppression. That's what I'm doing now, like the people in this show were forced to do decades back, but I'm simply now doing it at the next level of truth, the next layer peeled. That's all it is. Now, the point of nature sending a maniac like me to tell you these things is that the upcoming shift in logic we're going to employ is one that takes us from being geared toward the facade of free will or choices to the actuality of our construction, which is that of being a scripted product derived from necessity. In a binary universe, making the social veil is simple. It simply needs to be the binary polar opposite value to the truth. So whereas you and I are scripted products of necessity, doing what the universe needs, the social veil or facade dictates that we will perceive ourselves, ironically, as creatures of free will or choice endeavoring to do what we want. That veil of choice plays out against necessity, both permitting the universe to get what it needs while you fight desperately to get what you want. All of this behavior is derived from a simple, ironic logic quadrant. There is yes and no. They equal evolutionary necessity. They are the truth. And then, to facilitate the social veil on top, we facilitate truth through choice rather than necessity, leading us to replace yes and no with this combination, right and wrong. As necessity plays out, or the script of evolution, meaning what the universe needs, we often fail to get what we want through choice, or free will, and that failure to transcend then seems to be a product of other people's free will or choices oppressing us rather than a script, leading us to blame them, the avatars, rather than the creator or the script for wrongdoing. But at a certain point in our maturation, on the verge of adulthood, we begin to rewrite the script the Creator gave us, in the same way we would do when maturing in our parents' house in preparation to leave. That place, in most stories, is at the end of Act 1, when the protagonist leaves home for the new world. Of course, in our universe's lifespan, that's where we are, nearing the end of Act 1. And wouldn't you know it? We're on the verge of leaving Earth to colonize space for the first time. That's why. We're growing up, and technological efficiency does not dictate making accommodations for humans to succeed in space. That's counterproductive, immature, and ridiculous. Technological efficiency, as it has already many times over in our evolution, requires us to undergo metamorphosis yet again. But this time, as compared to our billions of years of evolution to precede it, the difference is that we'll be rebuilding ourselves. We will be integrating material technology and shedding humanity. So in order to do that, there's a fairly obvious requirement: knowing how we're built. You can't rebuild anything to be better than its previous version unless you actually understand how the previous version was constructed. So the end game here, ironically, is that you are going to learn the horrifying truth that you're a scripted product of necessity, but because there's also a social veil, you're going to believe exactly what the universe wants, which is that now that you realize you don't have free will, you'll believe you can build a being complete with such by transcending nature's influence. All we have to do is get out of these bodies and these brains, and then we're in control, right? We've transcended it. Yeah, but the catch is that will be simulated too. Infinitely. That's how the game works. It pisses me off to no end when people describe these truths as theories when in fact they've been in play since the beginning of time. As always, I'll give the great recent example of cars having something called horsepower. The horses were obsolete and got replaced, as has happened throughout multiple extinction events over time. I don't posit speculative theories about the future. I make assessments based upon the changes in the script over time and project from there. Evolution is a movement from darkness to light, like the plant ascending from beneath the surface to above it. It's just ignorance to enlightenment, complete ignorance to total enlightenment. That plant is the staircase, the subconscious mind, Jacob's ladder. You, it's the way to the top. That's what we are, movement upward. So perhaps the scariest thing we can ever do is look over our shoulders back into the darkness and return to it down there. It takes courage to face those fears, to have realizations about ugly truths. But most of all, what we fear about going back to that place is that we'll find the primitive version of ourselves, both individually and collectively, stuck there, unable to escape. And we will have to free them. We'll have to go below the surface, dig our hands in dirt, and unearth them. We want to know what's wrong with these people and how we can fix them. The only way to do that is to understand how they're built. So in the 1970s, on the precipice of a new wave of violence in the form of serial killers, John Douglas and his colleagues had to ask one question. What's broken inside these people? If we know what's broken, we'll know how to fix it. And the way to know how to find what's broken on anything and fix it is to reverse engineer the problem back to its source, or seed, and rebuild that source. Rebuild it absent of the flaws that led to darkness rather than light. That's the game. Nature draws you into their heads in order to understand the construction of their brains or thoughts or minds. That's the mindhunter, the one who goes below the surface into that darkness and returns with the knowledge of how the thing is built, leading to evolution. That seed or plant growing beneath the surface is the human brain. So in the same way I talked about a boy growing to a man after coming from a woman's body and then trying to get back inside under different terms, The same applies here. We are all born of one brain, meaning the singularity, or God, which comprises everything in the universe condensed to one entity, or idea. The Big Bang erupts, causing that singularity to break into a binary universe, meaning everything is broken in two and must be healed, like you see in the symbolism of a picture of a broken heart down the middle. The brain, or God, is the singularity. The body, or Christ, is the resulting second half of the disunification of the singularity becoming a binary universe at the point of the Big Bang. So all we are trying to do in this universe is merge that disunity between body and mind, heal the broken hearts. The path to doing so is transformation. If the singularity is an immortal deity by default of our construction, we must ascend to being such. The first step to immortality, of course, is biological immortality, meaning that you can be killed but do not die of natural causes. That definition perfectly fits our ascension to being AI, or artificial intelligence, in the future. In fact, it's necessary to be able to colonize space efficiently. And the greatest obstacle at this time in making artificial beings is not their exterior construction or facade, but simply one thing: their operating system. The most difficult part of replacing humans is replicating the brain. So it isn't a coincidence, not in any way whatsoever, that the rise to prominence of the serial killer in the 1970s paralleled the emergence of the personal computer. As guys like Ed Kemper were starting to be approached regarding their psychological insights, in 1975, Microsoft released an early version of what we now know as a PC, something called the Altair 8800 microcomputer. Not long after, in 1976, Apple released what's commonly referred to as the first personal computer, the Apple I. It was the first PC to offer a warranty, meaning it was the first time an artificial brain had been built well enough that humans could rely upon its operation or have it fixed if it malfunctioned. Our transition was already underway at that point. And nearly 50 years later, people are still calling me crazy for espousing the virtues of this process. So as we were then in the process of making brains for the average consumer, or the general public, the goal since then has been not only to improve them, but to make them increasingly available at lower price points. Today, as opposed to the mid-1970s, most people have access to an artificial brain that is extraneous to their bodies, but enhances their intellect, perhaps many times over, and to a point that is incalculable by any sort of practical means. We have indulged a profound evolution in relation to these artificial brains, but as we know, there's a way to go before we can reliably integrate this technology with the body and subsequently make humans become the equivalent of what happened to the horse, meaning they'll become mechanized, ensuring obsolescence of the mortal version that preceded it. We actually saw a hilarious yet terrifying version of this irony when the Nazis created innovative, lightning-fast panzer tanks that were left waiting around for infantry that were still using horses. They paid a significant price for mechanizing too quickly. Likewise, that's what will happen to us if we put artificial brains in humans too soon. We will become vulnerable. So the most important aspect of evolution is calibration, or pacing. The pistons fire at a rate conducive to necessity and nothing else, especially not reason or logic. All of which is to say that it's a fact that what we believe to be reason or logic leading to choice is truthfully necessity baring its teeth in the form of calibration. An easy way to understand it is like this. In the beginning of the universe, there was nothing, and therefore no propensity for believing in a God. As life formed and had no answer for its origin, creating an emotional wound, the propensity for believing in a God or gods became necessity. As we have begun making artificial brains on our way to becoming that deity through evolution now, necessity dictates that only some people need to believe in a God. That's where we are now. We have enough technology related to replacing the human brain that some people are calibrated to experience evolution as God's children, meaning under God like a parent to a child, and others deny the existence of God, choosing instead to believe that they are experiencing an autonomous life in which they are Him, more or less, on an individual level, meaning that they control the path forward. In the distant future, however, projecting from that predisposition, we understand that eventually nobody will believe in God, and it will happen out of necessity because we have to become Him. So you go from God not existing to God existing to a decreasing belief in God existing as our species matures to greater intelligence and ultimately replaces or becomes Him at the end of the narrative, where He then no longer exists as it was in the beginning, before it all goes dark and starts again. That's infinity, the infinite loop. We are always becoming, changing, evolving. And so your perspective and mine are calibrated in accordance with social norms, and not by choice. You get to believe under the social veil that you go to church or believe or not based on your upbringing, choices, or faith, but beneath that nonsense afforded by the social veil is necessity of thought. You will think and do what is necessary and not a damn thing less than that. Your perspective and mine are born of evolutionary necessity and are dictated by what the universe needs at any given time and through design. As an innovator, what I can expect from the world is to be assaulted by perspective, taunted by people with half my intelligence and twice the ambition. But that's the point. The seed doesn't become a plant that breaks through from the darkness of incarceration into the light of freedom above unless it travels through a lot of ugliness on the way to being seen for its beautiful truth, for the growth it has brought to the world. I'll get there one day. It sure as hell won't be today or tomorrow. But in the meantime, I know, again, that I'll be assaulted by a cacophonous array of circus clowns trying to undermine my efforts, and doing so utilizing a combination of arrogance and inferior analytical ability. And for better or worse, that is exactly what the protagonist in Mindhunter experiences. They want to keep him and his ideas marginalized in the basement, in the ignorance, away from the light, away from any relevance, away from the truth, because it scares them. So the question for our protagonist in Mindhunter will be how to get out of that place, how to rise above the negative influence and let the truth shine. I'm suffering the fallout of endeavoring to do the same right now, even if backed by just a bit less prestige than the FBI. The question is, how do I get my ideas out of the basement of the public's consciousness and into the light? How do I get them to let their guard down? The FBI, among other things, was founded upon the idea of making the pursuit of interstate criminals something controlled and funded by the federal government. In a time of gangsters with Tommy guns who roamed wild across America, striking at will, it was seemingly a necessity. But by the mid-1970s and the emergence of interstate killers like Ted Bundy, who terrorized Washington, Utah, Colorado, and Florida primarily, or cult leaders such as Charles Manson, a new necessity suddenly arrived. Nobody in the FBI's early days had to ask criminals much about why they robbed banks with machine guns. They were interested in stealing valuable things. There was a lot to gain by it. Yes, sometimes they veiled their crusades under the guise of being anti-establishment and pro-little guy, but that was mostly a way to keep the locals cooperative when stealing money from their own banks. If the locals believed in the cause, they were more likely to stand down during the robberies. So they were normally sold a narrative, and on the rare occasion, due to the Times rendering all contracts on paper, these criminals really did wipe out debt for people or otherwise make them richer. However, the formation of the FBI was the beginning of the end for that type of thing. And technology changed the world. Moving forward decades later, the 1970s were a different beast altogether. A time came when violent crimes or certain aspects of crimes seemed senseless or nearly unspeakable, and we began to develop a morbid, even if impolite, fascination with one thing. Why these killers would stoop to such depraved depths? Of course, those answers are hidden in their heads. So at that time in history, it became necessary to start questioning killers regarding that thing. Why? Reason and logic were then employed to deduce the truth about motivation. This happens so that, ironically, people will say things like, "If we know what's broken, we'll know how to fix it." Meaning that if there's abuse in the household as a kid, leading to becoming a killer, its absence would prevent that. That's how it's presented within the context of the social veil. But in evolutionary context, beneath the veil, what's being worked on is replication of the human brain. That starts, again, with understanding how it works. So the terms of reason and logic allow us to comprehend how a man like John Wayne Gacy, who lived in terror under his father's wrath, grew to be a sadistic psychopathic killer in desperate search of power over young people, or why Jeffrey Dahmer ate flesh from victims to keep them with him. We could understand these things utilizing what we believed to be reason and logic. But the slow end game on reason and logic determining motivation is that it doesn't address construction, which was perfectly fine in the technological disposition of the 1970s. However, we've come a long way since that time. Material technology has blossomed, and the term AI is no longer tossed around as a science fiction idea, but on many levels, a burgeoning reality. We can do many things that were unfathomable in the 1970s, so we have to adapt once again, this time indulging crime, and specifically criminal behavior, from a perspective more consistent with construction, as we are now more able to reconstruct artificial brains. As you can see clearly over time, we're losing more and more of our privacy in the name of security, and therefore the nature of violent crime will also change as it becomes increasingly difficult, by way of technological disposition, to avoid capture. That will set off a response which does the same as the people trying to enforce the laws. They'll go inside. The criminals will innovate technology related to identity in excess of fraudulent or stolen credit cards, meaning everything from fingerprints to blood type to DNA. That game of tag will forge new ground in technology related to detection and integrity, thereby fueling our binary necessity of accurately measuring the truth. The truth must not only be seen, but proven to be universal truth. At the end of our evolutionary pathway, when we become the light, there will be no darkness, no lies, no ignorance. All that can be known will be known. All injustice will have been eradicated, and justice in the form of peace and light prevails. And then suddenly it goes dark, before, bang, it all starts again, forever. So, of course, that's how this show has to begin. It's structural inevitability. It will start in the dark with a big bang that sends a brain ascending into pieces. And once it happens, the transcendent character or protagonist will be left to wonder one thing. Why? In the absence of that man being around to help him understand, his job, along with his co-workers, will be to answer that question by symbolically reconstructing the brain slowly over time. It isn't that the creators of the show are inserting these ideas subconsciously. In truth, we are simply all actors, manifestors of a life scripted for us, which we are now playing out in sophisticated images with seemingly real stakes. We love nothing more than to watch other people play fake, dramatic, written roles which are not themselves, but refuse to believe that we are constructed like that. And that's because we aren't at the technological point of discovery yet. It's time for some people to start hearing about it, but the rendering of technology designed to escape that ironic fate, which will sadly just keep imposing itself infinitely, is still a bit of the way down the pipeline, so to speak. You and I are not going to be robots. We're going to crumble to dust, unfortunately. But coming generations will be faced with moral, financial, and technological questions of the future of the human species, as upgrades to this bag of flesh become available over time, leading ultimately to competition that sheds humanity and mortality. That's a very long process. Accordingly, the brain is so incredibly sophisticated beyond anything else in the universe that it will take that long to fully integrate, refine, and successfully implement a transformation. So whereas in the 1970s, our protagonist is going to upset some of his audience members with his innovative nonsense, I tend to do similar now, in a much less official capacity, of course. The protagonist will be faced with introducing something new, groundbreaking, and uncomfortable. In the eyes of many at that time, it was good enough to say someone was a sick bastard for committing violent crimes, lock him away, and be done with it. But the necessity for asking why comes about, and suddenly, look what you have, if you mirror that. If you know why, you have a path to the killer, in the form of a head start on understanding his identity, and specifically through the conduit of his interior life. The question of why asks how the killer's brain works, meaning in terms of motivation. We know that now. So now that we know that, we ask how the brain is built. If you work in a lab with robotic AI or similar, you might literally be building a brain. Most of us don't do that, but we're at the technological point of necessity in the process that dictates we address one idea: structure. And I don't talk about the material replication of the brain. For me, that structural necessity goes through the conduit of psychological narratives. I deconstruct physical narratives to extract their emotional origins. Our protagonist, in Mindhunter, will utilize reason and logic, while I, decades later, discuss the psychological construction of the physical reality we create with our eyes. The social veil is specifically in place to allow us the ignorance of comfort until which time it is necessary to lower that veil slowly over time and reveal the truth behind it. That calibration is rendered through material technology keeping pace with social justice so that universal truth is achieved at the moment of justice. In the same way, my usual listeners have heard me talk about the male propensity for trying to get back inside the womb, so to speak, symbolically, through sex with women, we also try to get back inside the father. Yet the difference is that he's the mind, the head, and not the body. So in the same way we are born from the mother, or universe, we're also born from the father, or creator, and are symbolically separated from him in the aftermath. As the mother is the body in which we are nurtured, like a baby inside a mother's womb, our only path back to the father is emotionally, meaning we're desperate to know his identity. But like the fetus, we can only do so upon transcendence from this world into another once we've transformed. In the same way the baby leaves the universe of the mother's womb and meets the father before becoming him, so to speak, like the relationship between Jesus and God, our transcendence, collectively, will ultimately lead to the same. We, as the transcendent child, or chosen one, meet the Father upon transcending from this universe at the intersection of the seeker and the sought, or intersection at the middle of the infinite loop, and become him, thereby becoming whole, both physically and emotionally, or unified, in the form of the singularity, before the Big Bang erupts again, disunifying the singularity into the binary universe, and forcing us to piece the puzzle back together again. And again, right into perpetuity. That's how you facilitate infinity. Evolution is a roadmap to perfection, to becoming whole. So the universe is merely a straight line that connects our body and mind. If that seems too crazy for you, just go look at your neck in the mirror and think about the heart below with the brain above. The universe makes it so much easier to render truth through symbolic structure or construction rather than reason and logic. Countless scientists have stood at the water's edge with the waves pounding shore and thought, "Huh, I wonder how gravity moves," while the waves were either waiting to tell them or intentionally leaving them ignorant, depending upon when that event took place. It's all based upon calibration, pacing. If you were Isaac Newton, who discovered gravity, you were lucky to be the first person designed to shed the ignorance of its existence caused by calibration of the brain and become enlightened to the truth that gravitational forces exist. You don't come up with something. Realizations are not things that just appear out of nowhere. They are programmed, they are scripted, they are written, and they are calibrated so that your opinions will conform to necessity of social norms at any given time. If you ask why nobody else in the history of humanity ever had the same realization as Isaac Newton, well, it's because our knowledge and perspective aren't actually products of experience and a genetic lottery, but derived from technological necessity along a pathway of evolution that slowly sheds ignorance and everything else comprising our ego, or evil, or sin, to reveal a single, just truth in the form of our authentic self, the singularity, the creator, the father, the one. Now, any universe replicating our own in dramatic form, and from a standpoint of construction, is going to choose a protagonist according to the plight of this chosen one. And since this narrative uses the idea of reconstructing the brain to get back to the singularity, or God, and time ironically moves forward and backward in the same direction, toward the middle in the infinite loop, this protagonist should be named to say such. Now G, representing God, is of course the seventh letter of the alphabet, representing the three binary stages of birth, life, death in a binary universe, while also accounting for the merger from binary to singularity, adding the one on top. That means our protagonist, mirroring the idea of time going forward and backward in the same direction toward the middle of infinity, or the place where he, the seeker, meets the sought, or God, will be named with two initials or letters that both precede and succeed G in the alphabet, respectively. But there's more. The universe is nothing more than a suspended plane or line which continues to expand from the point of the Big Bang for billions of years before, in some way or another, it will collapse or recede. You and I are designed to perceive it in three-dimensional terms, meaning what is simply a suspended straight line or bridge occurs to us in our reality within the context of three-dimensional depth or distance. In those terms, the bridge goes outward from center in a spherical shape, in every direction, essentially matching the construction of the planet Earth and giving it a rounded shape, very much like a tennis ball. That's what the straight line and circle, or 1 and 0 of binary coding, come from. The bridge, or universe, in its simplest form, is a straight line, like a 1, while rendering it in three-dimensional terms makes it a sphere. So when viewed in two-dimensional terms, like numbers on a computer screen, in binary coding, it becomes a straight line and circle, or 1 and 0. Long story short, sort of, this means our protagonist, since he is ironically moving forward in both directions along that straight line of the suspension bridge back to the center, or point of origin, in the form of God, at the intersection of the seeker and the sought in the infinite loop, represented here by the letter G, and is also reverse engineering, or going backward, will be named with the letters HF. And those letters will reveal accompanying names that cater to both the idea of moving forward along the straight line and being suspended on it. This sounds completely crazy, but it is structural inevitability. In that light, we learn the protagonist is Holden Ford. Holden is an archaic version of the word hold, which is synonymous with suspending something, or suspension, and the last name is Ford, like the car brand. That's what the suspension bridge of the universal plane does. It takes us forward, suspended from falling. So in the naming of this character, we get those ideas rendered symbolically through the assertion of Holden Ford, going forward on the straight line back to the truth. A capital G goes around in a circle at its start, while also taking a straight line back to the center by its culmination. From a conceptual standpoint, it symbolizes the golden ratio, which is often considered equivalent to design perfection, as it mimics the funneling circle of both the universe's expansion and, closer to home, our revolution around the sun, as it throttles forward along that bridge with the onset of continuous universal expansion into the unknown. Your toilet, and every other drain for that matter, mimic a similar effect. If you have a fan nearby, when you turn it on, it will do the same thing. And of course, because of this, we've been programmed with phrases such as spiraling downward or spiraling out of control, which insinuates your emotional condition is descending to darkness, aka going down the hill, below the bridge, to the abyss of the dark waters, instead of ascending into the light above. Human history dictates that ascension has been a primary goal, even when manifested physically. the earliest ancestors, who had no significant technology of which to speak, didn't have the ability of creating suspension through evolution, so the earliest forms came by way of nature's gifts alone. For instance, if a waterway froze in winter, it could be crossed, allowing suspension in a place in which it would otherwise be impossible. That led to the realization of what would be necessary to cross those waterways in other seasons, precipitating the invention of flotation devices like rafts, boats, and ships. And that naval dominance, so to speak, peaked much later, with humans then realizing they needed greater forms of suspension that also facilitate ascension. They didn't just want point A to be on the ground. So that desire left the earth and gave birth to the aviation industry, which allowed us to suspend ourselves off the ground and subsequently led to wondering how we go higher and faster into space and beyond to the stars. So that theme will penetrate this narrative in Mindhunter. Our protagonist will be faced with the question of how to get the Quantico behavioral science operation off the ground, from darkness to light, the basement to upstairs. He's the seed, and as he does it, as he grows, he will also be faced with the question of how to stay afloat, how to not fall into the abyss below the bridge along that journey. In the end, all we want to know is how the hell you manage to stay afloat emotionally in the pursuit of love or not when the ship was sinking and told through a conduit of physically manifested ideas we can understand intuitively. This is exactly how the movie Titanic made over $2 billion at the box office. We want to know how you stayed afloat and ultimately rose above darkness. Kate Winslet's character is even named Rose, citing not only her ascension, but how she's grown and blossomed like a flower. But the place to which we don't want the protagonist to sink, like Jack, is below those icy cold black waters that will kill him, the ones that represent the unconscious mind, the place where Holden Ford needs to look, and where we will follow, down to the abyss, where the monster lives, where death drags you under as you remain helpless to stop it, frozen in your desperate plight. Like we see in Titanic, the people who can stay afloat in society will eventually rise. But those who can't, going to sink and die emotionally down in the abyss. Mindhunter takes us to the place where they live below the surface, trapped in the past. Children emotionally, yet men physically, unable to merge those identities. Unable to go forward, unable to rise.